Well, thank you, Joe, and good morning, everybody. While that's loading, my interest in organic agriculture started in college in the late 70s. That was the green wave of college enrollment for agriculture and history. More students were enrolled in agronomy and horticulture in that time period than any other time. Following graduate school, I spent a few years working as an extension agriculture agent at the county level in Oklahoma, and continued to work in supporting sustainable agriculture. And this interest in what works led me to leave and go work on an organic farm in Missouri. And then from 1989 through 2007, I worked as an agriculture specialist at the ATRA, National Sustainable Agriculture Information Service. And along with my colleague George Kepper, put together a lot of publications over the years. But the question that was posed to us at ATRA came from farmers. They were asking us the question, how can we grow crops organically or sustainably? How can we raise peaches without fungicides? How can we make compost? So this led to a lot of study on my part, and just developed this interest in the area that Michelle talked about. Lady Eve Balfour said that the most unknown and frontier part of agriculture is the soil biology. So spent a lot of time studying compost systems, compostees, and so forth. And that led me to move down to Texas to work with a family, the Ross family, who runs Betsy Ross Grass-Fed Beef and a spin-off business, the Sustainable Growth Texas. And so I moved down there, and I'm a full-time ag consultant with the company. So this talk is going to be about the applied approach that we're doing on broad-scale acreages in Texas. I want to start with three principles of soil biology. The first one is the classic one, and that is that the number and diversity of soil microorganisms drive soil functions. And so by managing soils with organic matter and rotations and cover crops and mulches and compost and organic matter management, we can increase this living soil, and the more that you can reach this goal of the number and diversity, the better functioning you have. So that really does tie into organic matter management and soil moisture holding capacity, because you have more humus in the soil and so forth. And this also echoes back to Selman Waksman, the famous microbiologist from Rutgers, and Krasilnikov from Russia, and many, many different plant pathologists have all said the same thing. The second principle, and this now jumps right into the ecology of what we're doing, and that is that a plant succession is mirrored by a below-ground soil food web succession. And then secondly, through a soil test using the fungal bacterial ratio, you can use that as an ecosystem indicator. And this is the roadmap. Now, this was the one that really, you know, a lot of people have been introduced to the soil food web and soil biology, but when you see this is a really applied approach to that. This is a succession. If you look in the lower, anyone have a pointer I can use? No one brought a pointer to this room, but lower right-hand corner, vegetables and row crops, the fungal to bacterial ratio there is just about 1-to-1. It's just slightly more fungal. And when I say that, I'm referring to this is a soil test, and they're doing microbial biomass, and this is micrograms per gram. And so the ratio there is roughly 1-to-1. And as you go up there, that becomes more bacterial. And if you look at the top there, weeds are very bacterial. And so, and another thing about weeds is that they respond to different signals. Nature's signals, so that they're responding to higher nitrates in the soil. They're responding to raw manure and raw humic materials in the soil, and those pioneer species of weeds and the plants that come back on an abandoned site. The pioneer successional plants that come in are responding to that. And then you have early successional grasses. KR bluestem is one of the classic grasses in Texas that was introduced decades ago but is now considered fairly invasive and is lower quality forage. Oh, thank you. Okay, thank you very much. And then you, as you go up, you have different higher level of section is Bermuda. So we're managing fields, and the preferred forage may be here, but it's back down on this level. So we're trying to push it down on that level. Then when it shifts over here, you have 2 to 10 fungal to 1 bacterial. This is where you have shrubs and vines, but also very interesting, native grasses are in this category over here. Deciduous trees have 10 up to 100 parts of fungal biomass to 1 part of bacterial biomass. And then when you get into old growth forests and coniferous trees, it can be very highly fungal dominated. So here's the follow-up principle, is that plants will induce a soil biological community to favor their growth. I mean, that's what soil microbial ecologists find out. That's what the literature says. But on the flip side, what we're seeing and what we're talking about is that through the application of biological amendments, we can influence the plant succession. Okay? We can push that succession by using biological amendments, and also obviously we can influence soil health and crop growth. So there's two tools that I'm going to talk about, aerated compost tea and liquid compost extract. Remember, the premise of this is that is compost. You're going to make compost tea, and you're going to make liquid compost extract from compost. And it's really going back, one of the key things to remember is going back to number and diversity. We have a tremendous diversity of bacteria and fungi in compost, thousands and thousands of species, but also protozoa nematodes. The other thing about compost is that it's composed of a synergy of components. And so you have microbial biomass, you have humic acids and fulvic acids, you have gazillions of enzymes, and you have humus particles or humus colloids. This is one of the commercial compost tea brewers. It's the GOT brewer. This is a 250-gallon unit. That the top part is the working engine, and then you just get your own tote and put it together yourself. But it has pumping mechanisms and has a compost basket that you fill about halfway full of compost. That is a nylon mesh bag. And then it's got a clamp. And then you clamp it on there. And then the aeration mechanism works for you. And then that is what they refer to as wave action. There's a lot of aeration. Typically, you start with a high-quality compost. They'll aerate it for 12, 24, 36 hours. They will feed that. They'll put some molasses or fish kelp, rock dust material in there. The concept of compost tea is that you are washing the biology out into the water, and then you're aerating it and feeding it to wake it up. And over the process of time, in that water's warm, you actually are growing the microbial biomass population in there. Then that can be delivered to the field. You can use it in greenhouses, agriculture, and so forth. The one of the key concepts there of compost tea is that it's very active and alive, metabolizing biology. Okay, that goes back to the Roman era compost teas, really got started in the 1990s in this country, and now it's a pretty big industry. The next generation is this thing called liquid compost extract. In 2004, a guy named Dennis Hronek published his patent on this. That's the Hronek flow-through compost extractor. And it has an auger. You can feed in compost. You can make different blends. You can custom blend what you're after. It's common to do both a little bit of worm compost and various other kinds of high-quality compost. That machine has a washing mechanism, so you see that the compost is broken down. It drops through there and goes up another auger, and has a washing mechanism. And so it is actually washing and extracting the beneficial components of compost. So you get this in liquid form without the bulk. Okay. Thing about large-scale farming is that while compost is like the universal number one beneficial soil amendment, it is very bulky. It costs money. It's very difficult to afford that and spread it on land. So this is a more practical and affordable way to get these benefits of compost on a large piece of land. And then it can be pumped into various tanks, and this is the compost substrate that falls out that is not used. A key concept of liquid compost extract is the dormancy of the material. It's the same conditions that are in a compost pile. Not all of the biology is active in a compost pile, maybe 15, 20%, 10%. The rest of it is some form of dormancy, inactivation, rest, and that is what you have in the compost extract. The other thing is that it is not aerated and it is not fed. Okay, therefore it has really good shelf life. Compost tea, you make it, it's very active, you have to keep it aerated, it's like little children, take care of them, and has to be applied quickly. If it's raining, you can't get out into the field, you still have to take care of it. And then finally you can get out in the field. The extract, the tea brewer that we looked at, 250-gallon unit, this extract machine can make 2,000 to 3,000 gallons per hour. Okay, so it's shelf-stable. It can stay in a tank for a week or so. You can put this on a truck. You can drive several hours to a farm. And then at the time of application, you can add in some other amendments that are going to feed the biology. And then you can apply that to the field. So that's a real benefit. And the second thing is that in this sort of applied agroecological approach, we refer to this as successional biology. Now, this is very interesting because you can take liquid compost and put it out on land, and then as the season progresses and as the plant wakes up and as it exudes a substance that tells the biology to wake up, they become active. And then they interact with the plant roots, and things progress from that point forward. This work has led to a term that we put together called liquid biological amendments. We have two broad approaches to this, and that is bioaugmentation and biostimulation. Basically, these are terms that you'll see used in the reclamation industry and so forth, but they apply to what we're doing in agriculture. Bioaugmentation is basically adding biology, and you can add biology by using compost teas, liquid compost extracts, various kinds of mycorrhizal inoculants, and other kinds of microbial inoculants. You're actually adding these numbers and diversity of microbes to the land. Sometimes they're general, very broad, and sometimes they're more selective and more specific for specialized functions. And then the biostimulation is a different approach. That is basically just putting in carbon sources that feed and stimulate the microbes that are in the soil. So, and then if you're aiming for a more bacterial succession, there are certain foods that really feed bacteria. Molasses, fulvic acid are two examples. In other instances, you want to feed more of a fungal system, and so you put in fungal food sources. These are the broader approaches. They are not so distinct in a box when you're actually working in the field. You kind of blend them up, but you have these as tools to use. This has led to a commercial application business. It's a customer service oriented business where we have an agriculture division, which is Sustainable Growth Texas. We do pastures and prairies. We do pecan orchards and vineyards. We've done a lot of TxDOT roadside tree plantings and some revegetation sites, and also an urban horticulture business that does lawn care and landscapes using this kind of approach. Okay, that leads me to, that's a quick introduction on the soil food web to lead me into three profiles or case studies of farm sites that we work with in Texas. The first one is Betsy Ross Grass-Fed Beef. It's in central Texas in Williamson County. That's part of this Texas Blackland Prairie. That's the soil, general soil areas of Texas. This is the NRCS conservation plan, and this is history of this farm was that it had been farmed in row crops for decades, and then in the early 1990s they started transitioning this land into permanent pastures. And this is the what you're looking at is the 110 different paddocks. The way this was set up with fencing and alleys, there's 8 miles of irrigation lines out here for livestock drinking water. And the way that was set up was basically those are mostly 5-acre paddocks, and each one was set up as a monoculture at the time. And like some are in gamma grass. There's like six different kinds of Bermuda grass. There's dall blue stem. There's switchgrass. Just a number of different things. And then the land around that is traditional agriculture, and that area is row crops. It's 100% GMO cotton and corn, totally farmed with chemicals. This is Betsy Ross and her son, J.R. Betsy's now a 73-year-old ranchwoman. She grew up on a ranch in West Texas. Her brother is a veterinarian and still runs the family ranch. It's a 10,000-acre ranch in Sonora, Texas. It's about 4 hours west of this site. Betsy had a long career but has been on the farm since 1992. For the first 10 years, they ran the farm in row crops for a few years the same way that they had for years, all chemicals. And then they started going into pastures and rotational grazing. Same thing, they ran it with the traditional chemicals, whatever the university said, they tried all that. They tried it all. And they just got tired of it because guess what? The same weeds kept on coming back after they applied more herbicides and the same old fertilizer. So in 2002, Betsy read the soil biology primer from USDA and got interested in this organic thing and started asking questions, and one thing led to another, and she ended up on a four-wheeler pulling a 100-gallon tank, driving through her pasture spraying compost tea. And everybody thought she was crazy, but it started working for her, and it progressed from there. Like I said, the farm started off as monocultures, but it had a lot of integration of grass and legumes, various grass, and they'll seed in alfalfa into grass. And another example is that this mostly warm season grasses, but in the fall they will do a no-till seeding of oats, vetch, and clover into a warm season pastures. And last year, they out of 530 acres, they seeded 130 acres with fall sown forages. That way, they can get year-round grazing. And then this is some of the vetch they put in there, and so this allows them to do grazing year-round. And they also do when they have a really really lush field, they'll do a real short-term grazing. They call it flash grazing. This is a South Devon cross, and this is some genetics that were put together by Joe David, the veterinarian out in West Texas. And so this animal is well adapted to this kind of growing system. The other thing about this farm is that another choice that organic farmers have to make is what works for them in the area where they are. So it'd be probably more difficult to actually achieve an organic farm in this area doing just corn and cotton. I mean, the weed pressure that you'd have to deal with, the GMO contamination that you would have to deal with from your neighbors would be really, really intense. So this choice of going towards rotational grazing is really more amenable to doing organic right where they are. So they've done rotational grazing for all those years, and then in 2008 and 2009 they've switched over to mob grazing. And there's a guy named Ian Mitchell Inns from South Africa. He's a holistic management resource educator. He has a really large ranch there in South Africa, and he has a herds of 4,000 animals that he'll run together in a herd, which he calls mob grazing. So now a number of farmers are doing this in the country, and that's what you're looking at here. See, it's kind of a long strip, and there's 100 animals in there, and the equivalent amount of pressure per land is close to 1,000,000 pounds per acre of how many animals you're running in there. So they'd take the same 5-acre paddock, but now they'll take it and they'll do narrow strips in there. They run a higher density animals for a shorter period of time. So they're grazing, but they're also trample grazing. The concept here is to get a lot of trampling of the organic matter and to build the organic matter in the soil, and then also to induce a natural sort of succession. The way Ian describes that is as there's seeds out there. I mean, there's clover out there. Just get it to grow by managing the soil with this grazing system. Okay, the other thing, this is what the company uses now, or basically one-ton trucks with 500-gallon tanks on the back. The way that works is you can take a 500-gallon truck out, and if you put out 20 gallons per acre, you now can cover 25 acres with one truck. You can also put a 1,000-gallon nurse tank on the trailer hitch, pull 1,500 gallons, and then you can go out and treat a 75-acre farm. So we'll go out and do a 150-acre farm. We'll take two trucks, two guys out. We'll drive around the pastures and deliver the material. So this is the working end of it. Very interesting the way that's set up. Those are 2-inch lines. They have pumping mechanisms where you can pump in, you can pump out. You can transfer from nurse tanks, from trailers, from truck to truck. And then it's got a spray bar on the bottom. And then you can drive through the pastures. And that's wild. That's really wild. There's a lot of driving through pastures, pecan orchards, and so forth using this method. So when you go out and look at it, you can actually see the drops. You can look at the soil. You can look at the leaves. You can see the droplets. They're depositing on there. And keep in mind, it's that successional biology. So we're driving through the pastures at different times of the year. Even during the drought, we were putting this material out onto the fields. Okay, we'll go out into the fields in the fall or in the winter time and put some of this out there as well. So in a pasture system, we're treating, we have clients that we treat, and we try to get out 3 or 4 times per year. So that's the management system. And that is the total fertility management that the whole farm receives. Keep in mind, what we're trying to do is we have a service that we're providing to farmers, but it's got to be practical and it's got to be affordable. The cost of organic fertilizers have gone through the roof. The so-called dealer of organic fertilizers in Texas is now charging $480 and $600 a ton per ton for rock phosphate. So the traditional idea of what it takes to fertilize in organic farming is changing. And what we're saying is that this is a practical and affordable way to treat large acreages. Okay, some of the methods of soil testing that we use, we do a soil biology test, we do soil chemistry test. We have a lot of on-farm testing methods. The penetrometer, we do root diagnosis and observation. We have microscopes we use. And then more lately, we've obtained the active soil organic matter test from Ohio State. That's the potassium permanganate test, and we're using that. We look at roots, and we're always interested in what's going on with the roots and showing farmers that we're working with what is going on. The penetrometer is a great tool. In fact, the way that this business got started was that Betsy was out treating her land and getting all these results, and people were stopping by and going, hey, if you're doing that on your land, I want you to come spray mine too. So, and one of the ones that really blows people away is the penetrometer test, because this is Texas blackland prairie. It's that gumbo soil. When it sets up hard, it's hard. But you can really get this penetrometer to go down into the ground. That soil biology working for you. Okay, that's a good-looking cow pie. And we're always interested in those. Another thing that's come out of this is a lot of collaborations. Texas A&M came out and did a CalPi study, and they used Betsy's Farm as the model, and they've actually made an association of how the CalPis look with the quality of them and so forth. We had another collaboration with University of Texas, came out and did an arthropod study, and they have published a CD-ROM on soil arthropods. But in this particular instance, you see the broad view, and if you see close-up, is dung beetles. And we see this commonly on the properties we work with. Eliminate pesticides, eliminate the worming agents in the animals, and put some biology back on the land, and the dung beetles will come back. Here's some more dung beetle activity. We love to see that. We call that ecosystem functioning. And we point that out to farmers. You have dung beetles, you have worms, you have rhizobial nodules on your legumes, you have organic matter decomposition. That is ecosystem functioning to us. We got nutrient cycling, we have fertility. And here's the other dung beetle species. This is the one that you'll see rolling on dung balls around. And we see that on many, many farms that we work with, dung beetles come back. Okay, the second case study or farm profile is Georgetown Pecan Orchard. That is an orchard developed by Dennis Purrs. It is also in Williamson County in the Texas Blackland Prairies. This is an orchard that is 25 acres. It was originally planted from 1978 to 1980 by a previous owner. And then Dennis Purrs, who's a retired engineer from Dow Chemical, purchased the orchard and started working in 1999. He managed it according to Texas A&M recommendations for years, which is all chemicals. That's how they talk about doing pecans in Texas. And then he's been working with Sustainable Growth Texas the last 5 years doing a biology program. Now, if you remember the succession chart, the forest ecosystem and deciduous trees are fungal dominated. So a lot of the soil management approach that we have is geared towards trying to encourage this soil fungal community. Here's one of the practices, and that is a wood chip mulch. So the benefit there, in horticultural terms, is you're controlling weeds, you're conserving moisture. Okay, that's everybody in horticulture knows that. But the other thing is that in soil biology, you're encouraging a fungal system. That's a lot of cellulose material. Fungi really thrive in that environment. And pecan trees naturally thrive in a forest fungal environment. Okay, so that really benefits those trees there. And then he also does chipping. He has a guy come in and actually chips for him. He builds these large windrows. I think he had about 150 cubic yards of this material last year. And he's got an irrigation hose on top. And again, that is a very rich fungal environment. He produces a lot of fungal activity in there. That is a partially composted half mulch kind of material that he uses around to mulch the young trees. Okay? 5 minutes? Okay. And then, as a matter of fact, Joe Bradford, who's going to be speaking later, has done some research. We got a lot of inspiration from his work. This is one of them. That's aerating the orchard. That's an old-time rolling cultivator that we just punched through the soil that way. This is driving the truck through the orchard, and we can put out mycorrhizae that way, get it into the soil, and the liquid biological amendment. And this is another example of biology working for you. This was some trees that Dennis planted in 2001. He had some packages of mycorrhizae, and those trees were planted the same day. The tree on the right had the mycorrhizae, and the tree on the left did not have the mycorrhizae, and I just took those pictures a couple weeks ago, and that's what the trees look like. This is horse herb, interesting little plant. That's a ground cover that is adapted to a woodland condition, and it's perfect for an orchard floor in pecans. It's a fungal indicator. Okay, I'm going to just go back to my last profile is a ranch in Erath County. It's in the West Cross Timbers. And I'm going to quickly go through that. As the whole point there is that's a 770-acre ranch with five parcels. It had Bermuda grass, had overgrazed native prairie, and it had an ungrazed or non-grazed native prairie. And it had some plowed land and it had some fallow pasture. But basically, the way that we managed that was based on a soil test. And depending on the kind of ecosystem that was there, we would blend up these custom blends and go out and spray the land. And so this is the soil test. And what it was telling us that the non-grazed native prairie had a very high fungal level. It had a 7-to-1 fungal to bacterial ratio, but it had very low fungal activity. So basically what we did was we just mixed up a brew and went out there to stimulate what was already there, okay? And it just bounced back. The land really bounced back. The other concept that we got out of this was the seed bank. There's a seed bank in the land that you can stimulate and bring back. Okay, so basically, I have to jump through the data and just give you the quick results. The Bermuda field came back. It was lush. Now, here's one little trick there is that when you're working with transitioning to organic and sustainable, you're still dealing with people who want to do it the old way. So the manager jumped out and went out and threw out some ammonium nitrate on us. But anyways, that was the result. It worked pretty good. That is one of the pastures in Klein grass that came back real nice. This is the little blue stream prairie. Basically, what you're looking at is a spray line. On the left is the sprayed prairie, and on the right is where it wasn't sprayed. Outside the spray line is low grass density. You can see down into the duff and thatch on the soil surface. Inside the spray line is thick density of grass and the rejuvenation of that little blue stem prairie. Here's another one. That's two sides of a fence. The side on the right was where we sprayed, and again that seed bank responded to this and came back. That's the little blue stem growing there, highly visible. On the left side of this fence where it wasn't sprayed, it didn't respond the same way. That's a great demonstration of how that seed bank can come back for you. And then this owner was interested in the rejuvenation of the prairie and wildflowers and so forth, and we achieved that on this land. All right, thank you very much. Yes.
I had a question on, do you look at the diversity of microorganisms when you put them out and then do you sample after it? I mean, how can you account that it's due to actually the growth of that? Do you like microbial counts and look at the diversity to make sure that what you're seeing is actually a result of what you're applying? How do you know you're not getting competition with the existing microorganisms that are in the soil?
We do a lot of soil testing. We do a lot of microscopy, but our approach on the microscopy is of a more on-farm kind. We can't do the microbial counting ourselves. We have to send that to the land. I mean, to a lab. We're kind of a results-oriented company. I mean, we have to work with we're working with landowners. So basically, we have feedback from them on how much hay yields they're getting. We had an example this fall where fall armyworms were marching through one of these fields where they did the oats. We went out and sprayed it. We did monitor the Brix levels in the forage, and we raised the Brix. And the armyworms left that field, and they're over in the neighbor's fields. So that's the kind of work we're doing. We do have some collaborations with a couple of universities and with USDA to kind of get more of that data-oriented, you know, results, but...
Because it just seems like you're looking at people who drastically change
dung beetles that may, it may not just be associated with the microbial communities that you're applying this to.
Sure, sure. And it's, we're also working with people when we're working with folks who do cattle grazing and so forth, is cultural management practices. So we advise them on that, and that has to work in combination of what we're doing at the same time. So all that leads back to, you know, why dung beetles are coming back, for sure. Yes?
On the Ross farm, where you have the mob grazing, are there any areas where they do the mob grazing but not the spraying as well?
The
question would lead into how do you separate out the effects, particularly where you've got a lot of that treading, mob grazing, a lot of aeration going on,
right,
and natural nitrification,
right,
going on.
The mob grazing started 2 years ago, but prior to that had been rotationally grazed for the last so many years. So that's all relatively new. Now, the thing that Ian Mitchell Inns is emphasizing is that you can achieve these benefits, the increased organic matter, carbon, ecosystem functioning with mob grazing alone. And it just so happens that's what the, you know, Betsy Ross started with, was this land spraying method. That's the company that we have. We're working with a lot of landowners who don't have the infrastructure to do mob grazing. There's a huge amount of fencing and daily, you know, management of those cattle to do that kind of mob grazing. So it varies from farm to farm. Yes? I'm not really sure. We don't really, we basically look at the data and we look at indicators. So for example, we can even look at a chemistry soil test and look at base saturation numbers and infer, you know, that what's going on with the soil just from that. Same thing with the soil biology test, the fungal to bacterial ratio, what's the activity level of bacteria and fungi, what's the mycorrhizal colonization level. All those are kind of indicators to us of what the land is doing and what we can do to go back and manage and work with the land.
So how do you standardize the sample, though? How do you do your sampling? Do you handle the sample?
All that's standardized. That's just good sampling procedures. And what are they? It's the same thing you would do for any other soil test, with a soil probe for soil chemistry, 6-inch depth, and for soil biology, it's the depth close to the plant roots. And soil biology samples have to be shipped overnight to get to the lab quickly. If you're doing a liquid extract, that has to be packed on ice, for example, to keep it chilled, and sent overnight for express delivery. Our sampling methods are easy. That's the easy part. Now, just put it all in perspective. This soil biology work and lab test stuff is not, it's not a nail, it's not like a hammer on the nail of the head. There's a lot of variability out there. So it's just like any other kind of soil test. You have to look at them as a roadmap. Yes?
Yeah. Sure whether or not you'll be able to answer this on there, but where I'm from, a lot of the landscapers are using this, and oftentimes they'll come in to us at the university with the food web test to ask questions relative to the interpretation, especially with what we refer to as our critical levels. So you get these particular ratios of fungi and bacteria on there, and the question I have, where's the science behind at least establishing, you know, on there what they suggest, you know, may not be wrong. I don't know. But I can't find any
right
data to at least with some of those systems on there. It's not, you know, maybe right, but I don't know where the science is that's actually driving those
Sure. Tons of it. I mean, it, you know, you can develop a whole library of literature to support some of this. This is one. This is on the fungal to bacterial ratio. This was really surprising to us, was how fungal the prairie is, and that led us to also have a better understanding of native grasses and where they fall on this succession, and help us develop that as a land management procedure. But anyways, drawing from the literature, this one particular study we found was very good. That was Soil Biology and Biochemistry, year 2002, from Vanessa Bailey, and they found, they did a site where they did a restored prairie. And they also, on the same site, the land was continued to be farmed with corn and so forth. But on the restored prairie, they were getting 3.5 fungal to bacterial ratio. And on the land adjacent that had been continued to be farmed in row crops, the ratio was 0.85 to 1. So there's a real trend there. I mean, that was really something that supported what we were doing. We found that. And in our study, those are soil tests. The remainder field was 0.26. The grazed prairie on this same ranch was 0.65. And the undisturbed, non-grazed prairie was 7 to 1. And that's all in the same farm. It was the way it was managed. It was heavily overgrazed. So they had really been degraded. And where it was undisturbed, it was still in its more natural condition. So... But, you know, we draw upon literature like that to infer and to understand what we're trying to do.
Well, I understand that. I mean, I know there are those types of papers. But then the extrapolation is going to the highly maintained amenity residential landscapes. And
that,
maybe some of the inferences may be correct. But
that's easy. In the practical world, that is easy. We do seven applications per year. With this approach, and that's about every 6 weeks you're coming back out with some kind of a treatment. There's a couple applications of a dry organic fertilizer blend, and the rest of them are these various bioaugmentation and biostimulation practices. And we've got 1,300 properties in Dallas and Houston and Austin that we manage, and they're just as nice as the neighbors. So. Yes.
You're a consultant, and so obviously you're making a business. But for those people that are skeptical, it seems that and you have great case studies, good examples. What is your view? Wouldn't it make sense to have some sort of replicated strips or something where actually the U.S. as a business can actually demonstrate to the public that the events are real and that it actually enhances your business?
Yes, that's a good point. And one would be a demonstration kind of strip. We do have a couple collaborations underway with universities where we're doing strips. They're replicated, they're peer-reviewed. We're just waiting on some data to come in on those.
Okay.